are listening to AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you on your Friday afternoon. Glad to have you with you. I'm riding solo today, as we talked about during the last hour. Man, whatever is going around with that cold has definitely gotten everyone here at the station. I've had a couple of producers that were not looking so good, including one of them that was supposed to produce today's show. I ended up sending her home because, she definitely was not looking like she was in good shape. But that's all right. I can ride solo with you today. It's going to be riveting to watch on Facebook Live because all you're going to see is an empty chair on the other side of the glass since I don't have a camera pointing at me. But we have lots planned on the program for today. Coming up, we are going to be speaking with someone from Media Matters. That's Andrew Lawrence. He is their senior researcher, talking about how Fox News has responded to this whistleblower controversy and kind of the difference in their coverage between their, well, real news division, as real as it can get, and also their opinion division. We're going to be talking about that later in the show. Also, if we have time, I might play back an excerpt of a show Paul Metza is doing tomorrow on the Wall of Power Radio Hour. He had just an absolute incredible interview with John Kirikou. He is a CIA agent that was actually imprisoned a few years ago for uncovering the torture policy of the Bush administration. So we might play back a segment of that interview coming up later on in the program. But first, I am happy to welcome in David Schultz, political science professor at Hamline University, as we are going to unpack what's been happening with the impeachment that's possibly happening against President Trump, what's been happening with this whistleblower, because there is a lot to unpack and go over, especially in terms of strategy, because that's really what I want to talk about. How should the Democrats proceed as they consider impeachment? Hey, Professor David Schultz, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, certainly lots to unpack. We could probably go for about 3 hours on this, but unfortunately time is limited. But let's get right into something here with Nancy Pelosi, because I found what she's doing kind of interesting, because at least to me, as I've read through what she's been talking about, what her plans are for possible impeachment, she's essentially saying that the 6 House panels that are currently investigating Donald Trump would compile evidence against him and share it with the House Judiciary Committee, which would then decide whether to recommend articles of impeachment to the full House. But to me, David, there's just one problem. Haven't we already been doing that since July, essentially? What's changed in what Pelosi has been saying and doing?
Yeah, and one level, nothing has changed, except there are two, I'll say that, nothing has changed, but now having said that, there are two changes. Okay, the one change, which is the most explicit, is her now saying that the purpose of these oversight of Congress's constitutionally permissible powers to do oversight investigations now has a focus in a different way than it had before. And that focus is to ask the question, are there instances or evidence that would suggest that Donald Trump deserves to be impeached? And I think that on one level is the bigger focus at this point, along with the fact that we have a formal acknowledgement by Pelosi that they're in a process here that's actually uses the word impeachment now, which she didn't want to use before. But otherwise, for the most part, nothing has changed. What's been going on in terms of all the different committees, in terms of oversight, everything is still going to continue. But now one can say it's that focus on that question. Do we have grounds for at least one article of impeachment to move against the president of the United States?
Let's move to the timing of this as well and kind of the timeline we might be looking at, because at least as far as I've seen, she's not really given a specific timeline on impeachment. Do you think this is kind of her way of playing 3D chess? Because as he wrote about in MinnPost the other way, the timing of this for the Democratic Congress is really important to try to maximize the impact that this could have on Trump's 2020 campaign.
You're right. And keep in mind, first off, a couple of things. Impeachment is not a criminal process. It's a political process, and it's a political decision. So whenever anybody jumps up and says, this is just all political, on one level, yes, it always is. The judgment of whether or not the president of the United States is ultimately fit to sit in office is entrusted by the Constitution to the House and to the Senate, which means they're making some political and constitutional judgments about, you know, fitness for character. But having said that, take us back to the Mueller report, where lots of us were looking at the Mueller report saying, gosh, there's at least, 11 instances in there of possible obstruction of justice. There seems to be a lot of evidence in there that the president did a lot of bad things. Why not move on impeachment then? And I think there was two answers. You know, one of them was the fact that there wasn't the public opinion behind doing this. And part of what you have to do is to get the public behind you in terms of supporting impeachment. But second, the votes weren't there, because we know that you would have to not only get the majority vote in the House of Representatives, but a two-thirds vote in the Senate. Wasn't clear back then if they had the majority in the House, certainly didn't have the two-thirds in the Senate. And what would have happened, possibly, is that if the House did actually vote to impeach, then Trump faces a trial in the Senate and he's acquitted. Trump gets to run around and say, look at that, I'm innocent of all charges, I was acquitted in the Senate. On the other hand now, with this new sort of inquiry going on here, we don't have a clear timeline. We have a lot of false analogies here. For example, Clinton back in 98, the House did a formal resolution saying we're starting impeachment. We didn't really have equivalents like that with Nixon or with Andrew Johnson. And that's important because the House could take several months. And under the scenario I'm sketching, let's say it takes 6 to 8 months to gather information. Again, not unusual given what we saw with Nixon and what we saw with Clinton. About 6 to 7 months from now puts us where? Sometime in the spring. Let's say now the House does find that there are grounds to impeach the president, votes somewhere around April or May of 2020 to impeach. Why is April or May, I'll ask you, why is April or May a significant time to do an impeachment?
Well, April and May, you're talking about where we'll likely already know who the Democratic nominee will be for president. And, of course, we're also getting close to convention season.
Exactly. And we're assuming that Trump will be the nominee. So now we put the decision about a trial in the Senate in the hands of a Republican-controlled Senate when right around convention time. Now we have to think in terms of what will the Senate do. Now, will Mitch McConnell basically say, well, we're not going to hold a trial and just let it go? That runs a risk for him. B, does he hold a trial? And if the Republicans exonerate the president, that might cause a problem. On the other hand, if they also exonerate, what becomes critically important here, too, is the fact that next year, 35 senators are up for election. Of those, 23 are Republicans. If the Senate does hold a trial, does exonerate, and it gets us and it's happening during what, the conventions and general election, to what extent does this mobilize Democrats? Yes, it might mobilize Republicans, but mobilize Democrats, but also at the same time puts the Senate and the Donald Trump basically, I'm going to say that, politically on trial for whatever they've decided to do. So I think this is a smart tactic for the Democrats to push this as close as the general election as possible, so that Trump has to campaign under impeachment, and the Senate gets, and Mitch McConnell has to make a decision what it wants to do in terms of those impeachment charges.
So some interesting points you just made there, and I want to unpack a few of these in just a minute, including what Mitch McConnell could do. But I also want to go back to this timeline because, yeah, what I was originally concerned about looking back at the Clinton impeachment, I have the timeline right here. It was October 8th where the House approved their impeachment inquiry. Then it was 4 months later in February where he was acquitted in the Senate. You're thinking we could probably drag out this impeachment process much longer than the 4 months we spent back in 1998. And really actually put this into convention season, which is why you're thinking it actually is not a bad strategy to start this now, rather than maybe waiting till January or February or next year if we were going by that four-month timeline we had back in 98.
Correct. And keep in mind that four-month timeline is, I'm going to say, somewhat artificial or arbitrary, because what that misses, that timeline, is what? If we actually trace it back further, it is the case brought by Paula Jones. It is Kenneth Starr's report as a special prosecutor. So depending on what the timeline is, it's not necessarily 4 months. It could have been, 8 months, a year we could be looking at to build the case. With Nixon, for example, between the time that we knew that there was a Watergate break-in, and the time that the House Judiciary Committee voted on articles of impeachment, it was over 2 years. It's so for anybody who wants to say that, well, 98 is our example of how to think about impeachment, I'm not sure, you know, with only three examples previously of impeaching a president, we have any really sort of good paradigm or example out there. And so to say that prior to getting to actually voting on articles of impeachment, if we need 6 months, or instead as the House needs 6 months or 8 months or whatever it may be to get the evidence it needs to do so, then that could happen. And think another way. The more the president and the Republicans stonewall, the longer this drags out, the more likely it is that what? It pushes it into the both primary season, convention, and general election. So in some sense, it would be to the Republicans' advantage for this to go away by what? Cooperating soon.
So Mitch McConnell, he's in a really interesting position because I would have originally thought, well, he's just overall not going to hold any impeachment trial. But he actually does kind of have a balancing act, at least as I think this more through, because let's say he actually does hold a full Senate trial and they end up acquitting Donald Trump. Well, all of a sudden that gives Donald Trump, of course, a major talking point on the campaign trail, saying he's been exonerated. He's been found free of any sort of wrongdoing. But, of course, as I'm sure you're going to bring up as well, with all of these 23 senators that are up for re-election in 2020, that does put them in a very tough position. I mean, the person I'm almost certainly going to zoom in on is Susan Collins, who's facing a very tough re-election. Same with Cory Gardner. But there's even other senators who could face some tough votes that come from kind of reddish-purple states like Joni Ernst in Iowa, or even, I'm blanking on the guy who's in North Carolina. So it could put some of these senators in very awkward positions. And yeah, Mitch kind of has an interesting decision to make, whether he wants to give Trump that major victory or help his fellow senators save face and having to vote on this issue.
Including himself, because Mitch McConnell is also up for election next year. So you're right. So this is going to be a question of how the interests of Donald Trump and perhaps the Republicans and the Republican-controlled Senate converge or diverge. And I think you hit it exactly where I tried to hit it in my MinnPost piece, is to say that again, in several critical swing states, in several states where you might have potentially vulnerable Republican senators, to what extent might Mitch McConnell miscalculate, lit Donald Trump off the hook, but now put tremendous political pressure on those Republican senators. So that's the one dilemma. The other dilemma is to say, well, I'm just not going to hold an impeachment trial, you know, in the Senate. And at that point, I think you have lots of people upset. You also have, at that point, Donald Trump campaigning in the general election, impeached, but with no opportunity to exonerate himself. I think if the Democrats can play this right, and I think Nancy Pelosi is an amazing chess player in terms of how she's playing at this point, the Democrats could set up a really good squeeze on the Republicans next year.
Constitutionally, is there anything that would force Mitch McConnell to actually hold a trial, or is it within his power to say, you know what, we're just going to ignore what happened in the House and not do anything on the Senate side?
Well, and that's a good question here, because one would presuppose that if the House impeaches, that the Senate would obviously have to hold a trial. The language of the Constitution implies, but doesn't require, but even if it did, what if Mitch McConnell says, I'm just not going to do it? Who's going to force him? And we know that the past Supreme Court decisions regarding impeachment have generally said that the Supreme Court, the federal courts, don't second guess the Senate or the House during the impeachment or trial process. Pretty much what? It's delegated to them at that point. So I can't see any way that you'd get actually an order from the Supreme Court saying, Mitch McConnell, you must hold that hearing. That's why it'll put the burden on him in terms of the choice of how he calculates how having a trial or not having a trial and how they vote directly on him and the Republicans.
So let's move on and talk about what Democrats could potentially put in these articles of impeachment. I kind of like what you wrote about saying that they should put something in here about sexual harassment to maybe reignite the Kavanaugh fight. But as a larger question, and we can take this in two parts if you want, going back to whether they should put something that has to do with sexual assault, sexual harassment in there. What about also Democrats? Do they risk putting too much in these articles of impeachment where it could run the risk of looking like they're throwing everything they can in these articles where Trump can say, look, they're just throwing everything at the wall and trying to see what sticks? Or should they actually be more focused and more limited on what they potentially put in their articles of impeachment? What do you think?
Well, remember again that grounds for impeachment are treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. And when they formulate their articles of impeachment, they have to formulate them in ways that they can actually prove them. Now, remember, this is not a criminal trial. The normal rules of criminal law, criminal evidence trials don't apply to the Senate here, but they have to be able to marshal enough evidence to convince senators to convict. Now, I would be very, very surprised, barring more information, that there would be two-thirds of majority in a Republican-controlled Senate to be able to do that. So, yes, possibly what they want to start with is, let us say, a variety of things here. One of them, they could say that this is an abuse of presidential power, use of his presidential power for the purposes of helping his reelection. We have actually thinking legality here. If we're actually talking about law, it is what? Encouraging a foreign government to try to interfere in U.S. elections, which actually is a felony. If, in fact, Trump was tendering an offer to say, you do something for me, I'll do something for you, that's bribery. That meets that standard. So I think there's a variety of possibilities that you could throw in here. And I think one of the other mistakes that so many analysts are making is they're assuming and saying, well, 1998 is our example of what happens, that you do a impeachment and the party that brings it politically backlashes. 1998 is a generation ago. We're far more polarized. Our political system, or at least our political process, looks very different. I think and part of the virtue of doing this for the Democrats is, yeah, maybe it gets the Republicans highly motivated, but guess what? It also highly motivates the Democrats to come out and vote, because now finally what? We know most Democrats, or close to most Democrats, support impeachment. And so I think the calculus is different. And when I said in my piece in MinnPost, perhaps bringing up something about sexual harassment, you know, whether it is about paying off Stormy Daniels or it is something you'd have to formulate, I don't know, in terms of perhaps the Kavanaugh hearings. I'm not sure how to do it yet at this point. We have to see if the Democrats want to go that direction. Is that part of why the Democrats were successful in 2018 is the mobilization of suburban women. And if you were to now start to bring up the issues of impeachment regarding sexual harassment or treatment of women, and again, the Senate or the House needs to figure out how to frame this, that might be a motivating tool to drive out and bring out lots of Democrats to vote nonetheless.
So let's talk about public support for impeachment and also some historical parallels, because as you were talking about 1998, not necessarily the best example, and I'd even go back to 1974, even though we didn't get to a full impeachment trial of Richard Nixon, Democrats actually did really well in the 1974 midterm elections. I think they picked up like over 40 seats. But there's another historical parallel I want to talk about that I've kind of thought about when it comes to impeaching Trump. And this actually goes back to 2012 and Scott Walker's recall election, because I think there could be some parallels there where at the time, and I remember, I don't have the polling data in front of me, but I know there were a number of people who voted in that recall election who didn't like Scott Walker, but ended up voting for him in that recall election because they didn't like the idea of recalling an executive from office. They overall wanted to actually vote them out in what would be a legitimate election or a more traditional election. Do you think there are any parallels between that and 2020 with people saying, well, I'm not really comfortable with Donald Trump, but I also don't like the idea of impeaching him either. I'd rather remove him via the ballot box in a very traditional manner. What do you think about that possible parallel between Walker in 2012 and Trump today?
I think that's a very good parallel, and that's why the circumstances of where the impeachment and perhaps trial might occur close to the election might be important, that nonetheless, the conviction in the Senate fails. Maybe the public doesn't really support or want the idea of the president being removed, but at the nonetheless, by bringing the issues up of what Trump has done, it mobilizes voters to come out in 2020 and say, listen, I didn't support impeachment, but guess what? He doesn't deserve another 4 years. And that would be the alternative way of thinking about it. I mean, what would have been curious, we don't know, is let us say that when Scott Walker, the efforts to try to recall him were occurring, let us say that voters knew that very, very shortly, within a few months of that, he would have faced a new election. What might have happened at that point, we don't know. But I do think you make a good point here. And so the parallel of having the impeachment process go at the same time as a general election and viewing the impeachment process as a way of handicapping the president and of mobilizing Democratic voters may be the way you should be thinking. We should be thinking about this.
All right. One more topic I want to touch on before I have to let you go here, Professor Schultz, and that is the polling on impeachment, because I find it really interesting, because when you look at just generic impeachment, where the questions are basically, do you in support impeaching President Trump or are you against it? Polling, well, over the past few months has generally been against, although I think a recent Morning Consult poll showed that it was the gap was certainly narrowing. But when you actually get very specific in your questions about impeachment, saying, for instance, if Trump did withhold money in exchange for dirt on Joe Biden talking about Ukraine, well, then support for impeachment went up to like 57 or 60%, I think, in that same Morning Consult battle. So is that actually the battle? It's not actually impeachment itself, that very generic term. It's actually the perception of what you're going after Trump for. Is that more the battle lines that are going to be drawn on the in terms of public opinion?
Yes, and that's exactly why the Democrats may want several months to build the case for impeachment. This is what I think the Democrats did very effectively, both with Sam Irving in the Senate and with Peter Odino's committee in the House back in 1974. It took quite a while, but the public hearings, the formulating of the specific issues, telling the public and saying, look it, the President of the United States obstructed justice. The President of the United States ordered a break-in. The President of the United States did X, Y, Z like that. That is what helped build specific support. And eventually, when the House Judiciary voted on articles of impeachment, they were very pinpoint in terms of what they were saying, that the president should be removed because he did X, Y, and Z. And I think the parallel is here. If you just say, should the president be impeached? Well, for what? You know. But if you now say, the president should be impeached because why? He encouraged a foreign power to try to investigate his potentially chief political rival in 2020. I think that changes the game quite a bit, because now people say, yeah, that sounds like dirty pool. That doesn't sound like something you'd be able to do. So think of the timing for Pelosi here also, as how do they use this process as a way of generally educating the American public regarding the case for what they think the president has done wrong.
Well, Professor David Schultz, really appreciate speaking with you. When can get a little politically nerdy with the strategy behind this. I'm certainly into that, and it's a fun conversation whenever we have you on the air, and definitely appreciate it. Have to have you back again sometime here on the program.
Of course, and we should point out the fact we're going to now try to do this about every couple of weeks.
Exactly, yeah, hopefully every week or two or right around there. So definitely looking forward to having you back on the program and getting your analysis, because it's important to talk about strategy as we head into 2020 and, of course, all the other important political issues. So definitely looking forward to that.
Great. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Professor Schultz. We'll have more on the way here on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee right after the news.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, September 27th, 2019. I'm Mary Sherman. The latest on an impeachment inquiry and whistleblower accusations against President Trump. The EPA continues its push against California's record on pollution and the connection between poor water quality and low-income towns. As Democrats work towards an impeachment inquiry, top GOP leaders are pressing for the identity of White House officials who told a whistleblower of alleged misconduct by the Trump administration. The Trump administration issued a warning Thursday to California leaders that the state is failing to meet its obligations on sewer and water pollution. A letter from EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler to California Governor Gavin Newsom outlines what the EPA calls significant public health concerns and deficiencies in the state's air and water quality. And it focuses specifically on the state's homelessness issues in Los Angeles and San Francisco, citing articles on human feces in streets and warning of potential water quality concerns. In reaction, a spokesman for Governor Newsom accused the president of weaponizing the government to attack his political opponents. New Census Bureau data shows that despite the median U.S. income reaching a new high in 2018, the gap between the rich and the poor is the widest in five decades. U.S. median household income was nearly $62,000 for 2018, but in more than half of states, the median household income was lower than the national level. Economists cite a variety of factors for the gap, including a slowdown in agricultural trade and manufacturing, and wages that haven't caught up with other forms of income.
The Annie E. Casey Foundation data snapshot shows that in 2017, more than 8 million, or 12%, of U.S. children lived below the poverty line. Barty Wahi with Children's Defense Fund Minnesota says after several years of incremental poverty reduction, the state is now just holding steady.
I think what we saw was a widening gap, particularly for American Indian children and for Asian children. We see that there are greater numbers of them living at poverty. And we also see that there's a bit of an increase in extreme poverty.
Wahi says almost 40% of Minnesota's American Indian children, who make up 31% of the state's child population, were poor, compared with less than 8% of white children. I'm Roz Brown.
Fisheries of the deep will now have a better chance of surviving the hooks of fishermen, thanks to a new rule requiring descending devices on boats.
The South Atlantic Fisheries Management Council approved a new rule requiring fishermen to have ready-to-use weighted tools to keep deep-water fish from dying of the bends during catch and release. Jessica McCauley is with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission.
This is for snapper grouper species in order to reverse the effects of barotrauma, which is what happens when you bring a fish up from depth and their internal organs are distended.
A recent South Atlantic stock assessment found 28.5%, or 460,000 red snapper died after catch and release. I'm Tramell Gomes.
I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service.
Hi, it's Tom Hartman. You know, Continental Diamond is special for a lot of reasons. The owners are Jimmy and Helene Pessis, a husband and wife team who had a dream to open their own store more than 30 years ago. They've built a business that is the gold standard. The readers of Minnesota Bride Magazine have named Continental Diamond the best jeweler for the last 7 years. Why? Amazing, friendly, no-pressure customer service, a selection of fine diamonds and design jewelry unlike anywhere else, and the fresh-baked chocolate chip cookies are pretty great, too. Continental Diamond in St. Louis Park and at ContinentalDiamond.com.
Tom Hartman here letting you know how you can go solar with All Energy Solar, even way up north in Minnesota. Lots of people ask them, isn't Minnesota too cloudy for solar? No. The truth? For one thing, Minneapolis gets nearly as much sun each year as Houston, Texas. But it isn't just about how much sun you get. It's also about having access to great local incentive programs that make solar affordable. Learn what your options are to save with solar and visit allenergysolar.com today.
Hello, fellow AM 950 listeners. This is Jason from Nightingale at 26 in Lindale. Come experience our delicious signature dishes and exciting rotation of inventive seasonal fare for my wife and chef, Carrie, and her team. Nightingale is the perfect place to gather for any occasion with our extensive wine, beer, and cocktail selection, along with our dedication to great service. We offer a full menu every day from 4 to 1 a.m., two award-winning daily happy hours, and weekend brunch at 10. More at nightingalempls.com.
Welcome back to the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. Brett Johnson running solo today. It is a live show, but I am the only person here because we've got some sort of nasty, I don't know if it's a flu bug, but it's been going around the office. Fortunately, I have immunity since I was one of the first people to get it. But yeah, we are out of producers today. They are all at home sick, so definitely wishing them well. But we still have plenty to talk about, even though I am riding solo here at the station. Happy to welcome in our next guest. It's Andrew Lawrence. He is the senior researcher for Media Matters. And Andrew, I don't know how you do it, but apparently you've been watching a lot of Fox News and trying to figure out what exactly they've been talking about since this whole whistleblower controversy. So got to ask you first up, mentally, are you okay after watching that much Fox News?
There is a lot of brain rot with this job, but fortunately, I have a lot of great coworkers, and for the most part, we have a lot of fun here doing this. But you have to sort of fight against that for sure. I go home and watch a lot of cartoons.
That's probably a good way to unpack from it. Yeah, absolutely. You're probably right. Sick of politics. It's probably not even worth going home and listening to podcasts or something that might be from the other side of the aisle. You're probably just politicked out at that point.
But it's been, I mean, you're right. It has been, they've been pretty out of control here the last, especially since this whole whistleblower thing broke. It's been extremely wild, and there's been a lot to keep us busy for sure.
So first up, I want to ask about this difference in Fox, because they often say this, well, our opinion hosts are separate from our news coverage. And in fact, a good example of that was actually, I was shocked the other day when it was, I think it was Judge Napolitano actually gave a pretty straightforward rundown of why Trump has actually committed very impeachable offenses. But as I've seen you guys report, that's kind of been about it in terms of the actual news department at Fox really giving this whistleblower controversy as much coverage as it probably deserves and compared to other media organizations.
Right, absolutely. And I think what they're doing, they're trying to run the same playbook they did during Russia. And you see them, citing or just saying that the whistleblower has a political bias or just trying to attack the Democrats for overreaching and stuff like that. I think one thing that I found so interesting in the whole Ukraine story is the way that the more traditional media just isn't buying the Fox News BS this time. And not just that they're not buying it, but they're actively pushing back and fact-checking people that start regurgitating this stuff, which is actually it's good to see. And who knows how long it'll last and if the Fox News talking points will eventually seep into the more traditional media. But as of right now, it's not. And you're right, like the news division, which Fox News touts all the time, we had their legal analyst, the official Fox News legal analyst the other day, said that even if Trump did offer a quid pro quo to the Ukraine, there's nothing wrong with that. Which is just wild, and that's
that's not
Sean Hannity saying that. That's Greg Jarrett, the Fox News legal analyst, just coming out there and saying that. So, you know, if you watch Fox News exclusively, you think Trump is fine, and there's absolutely nothing going on, and this is just a giant hoax, and he's going to just skate right through it. But you turn it to any other news organization, and it's just a different world. It's really wild to watch.
So one of the people that has at least somewhat been covering this whistleblower controversy has, of course, been Shepard Smith, who for whatever reason for years has kind of been the voice of reason over there at Fox News. But, of course, well, he's embattled in a big controversy with Tucker Carlson as they got into a bit of an on-air feud. And as you guys are reporting over there at Media Matters, it seems like the management of Fox has actually been taking the side of Tucker Carlson in this dispute with Shepard Smith.
Yeah, it's actually a little bit surprising, and I want to give credit to Gabriel Sherman of Vanity Fair, who first broke this story. He has incredible sources inside Fox News, but what he was reporting is that Shep Smith hit back on a Tucker Carlson guest called Andrew Napolitano a fool. Shep Smith called it a repugnant attack, and Tucker Carlson went on a tirade that night calling Shep Smith, of all people, an opinion host who doesn't deliver the news. He called him dishonest on numerous occasions. This is all like in one segment. And apparently, according to Vanity Fair and Gabe Sherman, Fox News management chose Tucker Carlson over Shep Smith, which is really surprising, especially because of the advertising issues that Tucker Carlson has right now. Fox News management really pushes their news division when they're talking to advertisers. So for them to take the side of Tucker Carlson, who really cannot get advertisers right now, over Shep Smith, who they push as this legitimate newsman, and they try to push him as someone who gives their entire network legitimacy. It's really surprising, but I would really recommend for your listeners to look up this Vanity Fair article by Gabriel Sherman. It's really fascinating, and according to him, management and the entire network just is in disarray right now.
They don't know how to handle this Ukraine story. Behind the scenes, they're freaking out, and they know that this is a bigger deal than anything Trump has faced, and they don't see a way out. But then on air, they're putting on, you know, the happy face, and they're saying that this is nothing. It's not going to affect Trump at all. It's just a witch hunt. The same playbook that they've ran for the last 3 years, but this time it does not look like it's working.
I almost wonder if they're trying to sort of run out the clock and hope maybe they can get public opinion working in one direction. Because if you go back and look at how they covered Bush, even towards the end of his administration and in the early Obama years, to me, it almost seemed like they just pretty much abandoned him. Do you think a similar thing could happen to President Trump if all of a sudden his support dips even among Republicans, where they might pivot away and say, oh, yeah, we were actually never for Donald Trump. We thought he was terrible from the start.
It's so hard to predict, because really, when you look at Fox News brings in, even their most watched shows bring in about 3 million people a night. And I'm talking about like Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham. So we're talking about like 1% of the U.S. population. So, I mean, it sounds like a big number. It's really not. But out of that 1% of the population, we're talking about the hardcore Trump fans. You know, they turn into Fox News to watch them say good things about Donald Trump. So I don't know how a break between Fox News and Donald Trump, I don't know what that would look like. I can't imagine that they could pull it off without a massive backlash from their most committed viewers, and that's, you know, that's their bread and butter. So it's they've really painted themselves in a corner here as far as turning themselves into Trump TV, because I don't see any way out of it for them. They've really created a mess for themselves here over the last 3 years, I think.
I want to go back to Shepard Smith for 1 second. The question I have, why does he stay there, or why does Fox News actually keep him on board? Is it really just come down to dollars from the Shepard Smith perspective, and then from Fox, well, they can at least say we have a somewhat moderate host on our program? What's the thinking for why that relationship continues between those two?
I think you nailed it. I mean, I couldn't say it any better myself, really. You know, Shepard Smith gives them this air of legitimacy that they can take to advertisers, that they can, you know, show to other networks and stuff and say, look, we're not Trump TV, actually. We have Shepard Smith. They tell Martha McCollum and Brett Baer and Chris Wallace as well, and, you know, they have their own issues. But, and then for Shep Smith, I mean, he's been there since the very beginning. I don't know what he makes. I'm sure he does very well. And I don't know what his career would look like if he left Fox right now as well. I think that, you know, trying to put yourself in his shoes, he might think, you know, look, somebody needs to be on Fox's air actually telling people what's happening. And if I go, like, who are they going to replace me with? Probably another Trump sycophant. So it's not that I really empathize with that, because I think that, like, what he's doing is he actually is giving Fox News this air of legitimacy that they don't deserve. But I'm sure it's a very complicated situation for him. But then we get back to, like, this whole Tucker feud, and for management to take Tucker's side over Shep, he can't be happy about that, I wouldn't think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And as you said, it's a very tough situation for them, because I think even breaking this down further, let's say they do try to move away from Donald Trump. Well, that actually leaves a pretty big void in the media market for a network that actually is very right. much pro-Trump. I'm blanking on the name of this news organization that Trump was actually giving props to a few months
OAN.
Ago.
OAN.
OAN,
yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you know about these other right-wing organizations? Could they potentially pounce if Fox News maybe were to somewhat turn on, or not even necessarily turn, but not have quite as friendly coverage? Because even recently, Trump has been complaining about the number of Democrats they've been bringing onto the air. Could we actually see the rise of a potential competitor right-wing news organization? Because at least in cable news, we haven't really seen much competition for Fox, at least over the traditional cable airwaves.
Right. It's, I mean, I don't have really a prediction for that, other than it would be fascinating to watch. I mean, the way things are going right now, we're talking about, you know, I think the latest poll is like 49% of people support impeachment today, which is up like 12-13% in like 3 or 4 days. So if the nation sort of turns on Trump, would there be an appetite for a pro-Trump media outlet? I don't know, but I think it would be fascinating to watch them sort of eat their own, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, exactly. Or even possibly have Trump launch his own TV network. That's right. Kind of what I thought he was going to do back in 2015 and 16. He was just getting in the race to run his own TV network, and oh, look, all of a sudden he won. But yeah.
And that's all he really wants to do anyway, right? He wants to just give feedback on what he sees on TV. I don't think he wants to be president. He just wants to watch TV and talk about what he just saw on TV.
Yeah, exactly. And it's almost scary. I mean, you have to watch Fox News for your job all day, but it's got to be kind of scary with the fact that literally he is crafting much of his policy off of what he's seeing on Fox News, not just figuratively, but actually literally.
Oh, it's terrifying. I mean, it really is, because these people, we're talking about Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham. I mean, they are pretty extreme people. And for them to be advising the man with the nuclear codes, it's actually terrifying. And I watch this stuff every single night, and you know, you listen to their ideas, and turning these ideas into policy is it's very troubling that these are the president's most trusted advisors.
All right, we'll have to leave it there, as unfortunately, Andrew, we are out of time, but we'll have to check in with you guys more often over there at Media Matters to figure out what's going on in the crazy world of right-wing media, because there's certainly no shortage of things to report on. That's Andrew Lawrence.
Absolutely.
He's the senior researcher for Media Matters. Hey, Andrew, thanks again for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me, Brett. I really enjoyed it, and I will hopefully be back soon.
All right, thanks so much, Andrew. We'll have more on the way after Art Beat for the Week here on AM 950.
Is Art Beat for the Week. I'm Elizabeth Horub, co-host of Connections Radio Show, and today I'll be letting you in on some wonderful arts events happening in the St. Paul area this weekend. Bring the kiddos out this Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Minnesota Children's Museum to see the book launch of A Map into the World by acclaimed Hmong American author Cao Kalia Yang. A Map into the World is a heartfelt story of a young girl seeking beauty and connection in a busy world. As the seasons change, so too does a young Hmong girl's world. She moves into a new home with her family and encounters both birth and death. As this curious girl explores life inside her house and beyond, she collects bits of the natural world. But who are these treasures for? During the event, Cao Kalia Yang will read from her book and answer questions. Copies of the book will be available for purchase, and Yang will sign books at the end of the event. Go to the Minnesota Children's Museum website, www.mcm.org, to learn more about this event. Come see a fun show at the North Garden Theater in St. Paul this Sunday, September 29th, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. The mysterious Old Radio Listening Society presents two of the best stories from the classic old-time radio vault, complete with historical notes and trivia. Their performances restage the great horror and suspense shows from the golden age of radio, including tales from Suspense, Lights Out, The Witch's Tale, The Shadow, and more. Each episode is performed live on stage with actors playing multiple roles and producing all the sound effects live. Look up the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society on Facebook or Eventbrite for more details and to reserve your tickets today. That's Art Beat for the Week. I'm Elizabeth Horub, co-host of Connections Radio Show, airing live Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. on AM 950, Progressive Voice of Minnesota.
I'm Candy Broffel, publisher of the Twin Cities edition of Natural Awakenings magazine and host of Green Tea Conversations, a new show for people who are on a journey to take responsibility for their health and play a more active role in their family's well-being. Join me every Sunday at 10 a.m. as I interview local experts who share the latest in natural holistic approaches in a fun and informative way. So grab a cup of tea and join the conversation as we awaken to natural health. Visit us at naturaltwincities.com.
Hi, this is Chad from AM 950. Snap Construction is arguably the most well-reviewed roofing, siding, window, and insulation contractor in the metro. Ryan is so excited about working with AM 950 and our listeners that he wants to help us grow.
This is Ryan, owner of Snap Construction. I was friends with Chad long before I started marketing with him. I was a bit skeptical of radio advertising before Chad convinced us to run ads. The advertising's been so successful, we want to help the station grow. We've absolutely loved working with the listeners of AM 950, and we all know how extreme extremely important this radio station is to the community. To help AM 950 grow this summer, Snap Construction will be putting up proceeds to assist the station in marketing on social media. Snap Construction encourages you to follow, engage, share, and interact on the AM 950 social media platforms. Together, we can all work to ensure AM 950 continues to thrive and grow in our communities. We stand by our work with a lifetime craftsmanship guarantee. For a free estimate or more information on our financing, call 612-333-SNAP or check us out online.
Hello, Seaver here, inviting you to our beautiful new location. Bring the family and join the fun at Minnesota's largest corn maze and fall festival. We're open every weekend now through November 3rd. Get tickets and info online at seaversfallfestival.com.
Hey everyone, Ellie Krug here from Ellie 2.0 Radio on Mondays from 7 to 8 a.m. This month, I'm sharing about opportunities to hear me in person. One opportunity is at Grace Lutheran Church in Andover, Minnesota on October 6th from 6 to 8 p.m. There, I'll be presenting my Human Inclusivity Turning, Gray Area Thinking. Go to graceandover.org for details. This is a free event. That's me, Ellie Krug, the idealist, trying to make the world better. I hope to see you on October 6th at Grace Lutheran Church.
Welcome back to AM 950. Brett Johnson on your Friday afternoon running solo as everyone else is out sick today. We got that bug going around the office here at AM 950. What I want to do next is play back a portion of the Wall of Power Radio Hour, Paul Metz's program that you're actually going to hear in full tomorrow because he had one of the best shows I've ever heard. He actually had a guest on his program by the name of John Kiriakou. Now, if you're not familiar or maybe don't remember his name, he was actually a former CIA agent who helped uncover some of the torture policies that took place in the U.S. government. And of course, it's a very timely interview, given that the whistleblower in the Ukraine controversy with President Trump is also a CIA agent. So we're just going to play back a few minutes of this interview and get John's thoughts on what's happened with this controversy between the whistleblower and President Trump and the Ukraine. Again, you can hear the entire program coming up tomorrow at 6 p.m. on the Wall of Power Radio Hour because John has some incredible stories about his service in the CIA. But again, here's just a portion of the interview. Hear the whole thing coming up tomorrow at 6 on AM 950.
John Kiriakou, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us today.
Oh, it's always good to speak with you, Paul. Thanks for having me.
You must have been as alarmed and in a way excited about the information that we're coming across this week with the whistleblower behind the Trump-Ukraine debacle. And give us a little insight into what your feeling is about what's going on right now in real time.
Well, I am excited, but maybe not for the same reason that most Americans are excited, or many Americans are excited. I'm excited because all of the mainstream media outlets are using the word whistleblower freely. They're not putting it on the screen with quotation marks around it, as they did in my case. You know, when I first went public with my revelations on the CIA's torture program, it took my attorneys a year to convince the news networks, specifically CNN, Fox, and MSNBC, to stop calling me CIA leaker John Kiriakou and to start calling me CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou. And finally, after a year, after I was convicted, they converted to whistleblower. But then even after that, MSNBC at least kept quotation marks around the word. With Ed Snowden's revelations, it became a mainstream word. And now with this new CIA whistleblower, I'm glad to see that they're using it. And before we get too deep into the conversation, Paul, let me tell your listeners, too, that there is a legal definition of whistleblowing. It's very simple. It's bringing to light any evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. A whistleblower's motivation is irrelevant. If he meets those other requirements, he's a whistleblower.
Well, you did what, 3 years in federal prison for?
23 months.
What? Yeah, a long time.
It is.
John, tell You know, we've had you on twice before, but it was a couple of years ago. So we have new listeners that have been listening to the Wall and Power Radio Hour. And for those that heard the first couple of shows and would like to be refreshed about your history, tell the people out there in Wall and Power Radio Hour land how you became a CIA agent and your motivations for doing that.
Sure. I was in graduate school at George Washington University here in Washington, and I was taking a class called The Psychology of Leadership, in which we had to, as an assignment, we had to shadow our bosses for a week and write a psychological evaluation about them. I was working at a labor union at the time, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and my boss was nuts, and I was actually a little bit afraid of him. He was one of these old school union organizers. He had had his back broken by scabs in, wow, in a strike, and one of these old school guys. And so I'm shadowing him. And at one point in the middle of the week, we had an argument, and I called him a racist, which he was. And he got so angry, he set a stance and he put his fists up, and I actually recoiled. I remember recoiling because I thought, oh, here it comes. But instead of punching me, he blurts out, my penis is bigger than yours. And I looked at him and I said, I quit. You're nuts. And I quit. And I walked out. Well, I wrote this up in my paper and I gave it back to my professor. And a week later, he sent me the paper back and gave me an A, and then wrote in the margin, please see me after class.
Wow.
So I went to see him after class. He asked me to follow him down to his office. He closed the door. And he turns and he looks at me and he said, listen, I'm not really a professor here. I'm a CIA officer undercover as a professor here. I'm looking for people who might fit into the CIA's culture. Would you like to work for the CIA?
Wow.
And that's just a portion of the interview. You can hear the whole conversation between Paul and John Kiriakou coming up tomorrow, Wall of Power Radio at 6 p.m. We recorded it today, and it's an absolute riveting conversation to go through some of John's stories about how he blew the whistle on the torture policy in the Bush administration and some of his other CIA stories. Hey, some things we're working on for next week, going to hopefully have Peter Callahan on of MinnPost to really go into detail about the dispute between the GOP and the DFL on this emergency insulin bill and how the Republicans have really made this a political issue. Also working on trying to maybe get Maureen Hackett on from Howling for Wolves to talk a little bit more about a push from both Colin Peterson and Pete Stauber to actually remove wolves from the endangered species list. It's a really interesting conversation to have because you actually have a DFLer and a Republican coming together on this issue. Is that good policy? Hopefully we'll learn more about that next week. That's all the time we have for today on the Repartee. You know what that means. Our music is giving us a signal. Our time is up. We'll talk to you next week.